Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the United States, we use the term brain surgeon as a metaphor to describe a person of superior intelligence and infallible judgment. Dr. Henry Marsh debunked that myth when he published his memoir, Do No Harm. Now, as he's retiring, he has written a new book called Admissions, which looks back on a life spent thinking about and operating on that most complex organ, the human brain. Admissions is published by Picador, and I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Marsh to our show now. I was wondering if you got any feedback or criticism from your peers after you published Do No Harm and admitted and described very vividly how brain surgeons are fallible.
The honest answer is none whatsoever, with one exception. As you may know, I work a lot in Ukraine, and one Ukrainian neurosurgeon said, you know, you shouldn't be writing things that will frighten patients. But that was the only time. If my peers didn't like what I was saying, nobody told me. And in fact, it was mainly the opposite. I was particularly concerned. I was very uncertain how my book could be received in America. I have a lot of American colleagues. For various reasons, I've been trained a lot of American neurosurgical residents who came to London to work in my department. And I thought most of my American colleagues would say, oh, this is all typical third world, useless, second-rate British medicine. And it was the reverse. See, I got lots of really nice letters and emails. But curiously, mainly from retired surgeons and some of the biggest names in American neurosurgery, names which are sort of godlike names to me. And it was as though, only when you've retired, you can actually start to admit just how stressful the work is. You can take the blinkers off. So I received virtually no criticism at all.
Well, the title of this new book is Admissions, and I'm assuming it's intended as a double entendre. What are you admitting to in this book? Anything beyond what you admitted in the first one?
I'm admitting it's more along the same theme. I'm admitting the fallibility, basically. Admitting to how difficult. People think brain surgery is very difficult. Yes, it is very difficult. But what's difficult about it is not the physical manipulations you do with your hands nor the technology. It's dealing with patients. It's dealing with all the emotions. Surgery, in fact, is a very, very, particularly things like neurosurgery, is in fact a very, very emotional business. It's not all cool, calm, and collected at all. It's the opposite in many ways.
Because the stakes are a lot higher when the surgery is dealing with a life-threatening condition or might leave the patient in a condition that would be, well, they wouldn't be able to live their lives the way they had in the past.
Well, worse than death, to put it in blunt terms. Yes, you're dealing, when you operate on the brain, you're dealing with what makes us people, what makes us human beings. So the stakes are very high, and it's scary stuff. But of course, you know, what the difference, we all know from our own non-medical lives, the difference between excitement and fear is quite difficult to define. At what point does excitement become fear? It wouldn't be exciting climbing mountains. It wasn't dangerous. Makes surgery exciting, of course, is the fact there is an element of risk.
I would think anxiety would be a key factor here. Should I assume?
Well, you have to be anxious. I was fascinated to read something recently about Chuck Yeager, the great jet test pilot, who said, I was always terrified of dying. It was fear which made me check everything out and be in control of the airplane, which I thought was very interesting. I mean, people have this idea that test pilots, like brain surgeons, are totally cool and calm. it's not like that. You're not going to do the job well if you're not anxious. The question is how you can control the anxiety and turn the anxiety into predictability and control so you get the sort of excitement without it turning just into terrible fear.
How has the practice of medicine and brain surgery changed over the course of your career? Should I assume that surgical techniques and the equipment have improved?
Oh, enormously. And in a paradoxical sort of way, progress in brain surgery is to make brain surgery redundant and unnecessary. I, as I describe in my first book, I sort of fell in love with neurosurgery at first sight when I saw my first aneurysm operation, which I compare to sort of bomb disposal work for cowards, so that's a bit more complicated than that. But aneurysm surgery, where you're operating on small blowouts on blood vessels beneath and almost inside the brain, has now been almost entirely replaced by non-surgical technology. Likewise, many small tumors, benign tumors, not cancerous tumors, can be treated with highly focused radiation treatment. So some of the most difficult, exciting, scary, technically challenging operations, which were around when I went into neurosurgery almost 40 years ago, are now no longer necessary. So in some ways, often technology makes things easier and simpler and safer.
You read politics, philosophy, and economics at University College, Oxford.
That's
University.
Right. Yeah.
And then, you, as you said, you saw this operation, and that led you to abandon all that course of study?
No, it's more complicated than that. I came from a totally non-scientific Oxford academic family.
Your father had been an Oxford don.
My father was a don at Oxford, yeah, among other things. And I went up to Oxford to read PPE, as it's called, not personal protective equipment, but politics, philosophy, and economics, and had what in those days was called a sort of nervous breakdown. Basically, I'd fallen unhappily in love, and I couldn't cope with it. And I ran away and abandoned politics, philosophy, and economics, and ended up in a sort of complicated chain of coincidences working as a porter, as a cleaner and porter in an operating theatre in a hospital in a mining town in the northeast of England. And while I was there, I was watching surgeons operate, and I thought, actually, that's what I'd like to do. And very luckily, I didn't really deserve it. My Oxford college said, well, you can come back and complete your degree, because I thought I probably would not get into medical school if I'd flunked and abandoned my first degree. So I worked like mad, got a good degree, and on the basis of that, was able to go to medical school. You need to understand, to American listeners, in Europe, which is it's a bad system, and basically school kids go straight from high school to medical school. In America, of course, everybody goes to college first. So American doctors are older when they actually become doctors. In England, you'll be 22 or 23 years old when you actually end up on the floors working as a doctor. I was almost 30 years old by the time I finally became a doctor. And I think that was a great advantage, because the difficult bits of medicine are all about communication, getting on with people, mastering your own problems and difficulties. The purely technical side, in terms of the purely technical operating, in terms of technical knowledge, are actually relatively easy.
You write that your plan was to see people suffering from real injury and by doing so cure yourself.
Yeah, well, that was when I was unhappy and screwed up and having my nervous breakdown. And I thought, maybe if I go and work in a hospital where people are properly ill rather than just sort of mentally ill, as I suppose I was in a way, I thought somehow a dose of reality would sort me out. And in some ways it did, although not quite in the way I expected.
You pioneered the technique of operating on the brain under only local anesthesia. What led you to believe that that was a better technique?
Well, that's quite it. Well, I pioneered that in Europe. It was already being done a bit in America, but mainly for epilepsy surgery. And it was because, for various reasons, I had these very strong connections with American neurosurgery that I sort of picked this thing up. It really was a technical change, because this is now 30 years ago, we were starting more and more brain scanning, became available. And in the past, in the distant past, if you had an epileptic fit, usually nothing was done about it. Or you were put on tablets, but you wouldn't be investigated because only a small proportion of people who have their first epileptic fit have an underlying brain tumor. But with the increasing availability of brain scanning, people who had a single epileptic fit would have brain scans, and you diagnose tumors at a very early stage of their growth in patients who are still quite well, and the only problem, though it's a serious problem, was epilepsy. Now, the traditional management for these patients was, well, it's too dangerous to operate on them because they're completely well. We can only make them worse. We know that some of these tumors are going to get bigger and even turn cancerous, but we should postpone treatment until then. And I thought, well, if you actually have the patient awake, so you can see, you get early warning of any damage you might be doing as you operate, because these tumors is a particular group of tumors called low-grade gliomas. They actually are in the brain, and they look like brain tissue. And the only way you have of knowing whether you're damaging brain or damaging tumor is by having the patient awake and getting them to solve appropriate physical or mental problems. So it was when I started doing this in 1988, it was certainly distinctly eccentric.
And what do patients tell you during the course of the operation?
Well, it depends, but patients actually cope with it remarkably. The brain doesn't feel pain. The only part of the head that feels pain really is the skin. So you anesthetize that with a local anesthetic. And I've done hundreds of these operations. And, you know, it is amazing what we as patients will tolerate if we trust the doctors looking after us and if we understand why it will help. So when I started doing this, as any person doing it, I had for a while had patients from all over England and all over Europe. But now, in fact, it's absolutely standard practice. So all neurosurgical departments will do awake craniotomies for this particular subgroup of tumors. So there's no longer anything special about it.
Was it
different? I'm kind of proud about the fact that I was. If I hadn't done it, somebody else would have done. I just got there first, that's all.
Was it difficult to convince the first few patients to try it?
No, oddly enough, not. But as patients, we are totally, you know, terrified. And if we trust the doctor, it's amazing what we'll accept.
And when you do an awake craniotomy, you frequently ask your patients if they want to see their own brains.
Yes.
Do they?
Well, some of them do. This is a sort of philosophical joke, almost. Maybe that's not quite the word. So when I operate, I use a microscope. And there's a video camera on the microscope, which is connected to a monitor, which is really for the nurses and my assistants, so they can see what I'm doing. But it means, in principle, because the patient's awake, they can see it as well. So I'd normally ask them, do you want to see your own brain? And most of them would say no. Some of them would say yes. And I'd then say, well, you're now one of the few people in the history of the human race who've seen their own brain.
And how do they react when they see it?
Well, that's amazing. It's crazy. Is that the real me? I mean, it is the last great impossible philosophical hurdle for mankind to cross, the idea that the real me is this 1.5 kilograms of fatty protein. It's a very strange idea. And the older I get, the more amazed I am by it.
I'm speaking to Dr. Henry Marsh on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. His latest book is called Admissions. It's published by Picador. Didn't you undergo some plastic surgery while you were awake? What was that like?
No, I had eye surgery. I had a retinal detachment, and I had to have what's called a vitrectomy when the inside of the eye is sucked out. But I was offered that under general anesthetic, but I said, no, thank you. But I then had a routine lens operation, which most people have for cataracts, which was done under local anesthetic. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't hurt. Well, little, slightly.
I've had that operation for cataracts.
Very many people have had that operation. And what's strange is that the surface of the eye is anesthetized, and then a sort of sticky plastic film is stuck to it. And you feel nothing. And you can't see anything. You just see vague light and shadows. But I was in my surgeon, whom I knew, because I'm a doctor myself, then gave me a video, an old sort of videotape, of the operation. And I could sort of see my eye bashing around, looking rather anxious. And then this microscopic instrument goes into the eye and puts this artificial lens in. Modern medical technology really is simply amazing.
But since the doctors know what can go wrong, do they turn out to be more difficult patients on the whole?
In my experience, no. I mean, certainly as you get promoted up the professional ladder, the final accolade is you end up operating on fellow doctors. You operate on your own tribe. And, of course, as doctors, we are the ultimate informed consumers, and we are in a better position than our patients to choose whom to go and see if we have a particular medical problem. But because when we treat doctors as patients, they're members of our own tribe, we feel more anxious about it. All the professional detachment we have learnt from a very early stage, which to some extent means we have to see patients as being other, as being separate from us, because their empathy is painful. That tends to be sort of a bit broken down when we operate on fellow doctors. So we don't really like it. It's an irrational fear, because on the whole, doctors as patients know that things can go wrong. We have chosen the person to treat us quite carefully. And if things go wrong, the chances are they'll understand it and forgive us. But we, because it's too close to the bone, it'd be almost like operating on a member of your own family, which psychologically would be almost impossible. So I think most of us, when we operate on our colleagues, feel more anxious than when we operate on ordinary patients, so to speak.
Do you understand the brain and its nuances better than you did when you were an intern 40 years ago?
I brain surgery is relatively crude. I mean, one cubic millimeter of the surface of the brain, the cerebral cortex, where the most of the nerve cell bodies are to be found, one cubic millimeter contains 100,000 brain cells. And those 100,000 brain cells will have up to 1 billion connections. Now, that's one cubic millimeter. It's a minute fraction of the brain overall. Now, the smallest, the main neurosurgical tool instrument is a sucker. It's a microscopic vacuum cleaner, because the brain is soft and a little bit like sort of thick cream cheese in consistency. Now, the smallest microsurgical sucker a brain surgeon uses has an internal diameter of about 2 millimeters. So that's 2 millimeters. That's at least, you know, hundreds of thousands of brain cells destroyed every time you put the sucker into the brain. So brain surgery, in a sense, is very crude. I am very interested by what is called true neuroscience. So I read lots about it. And the more I read, the more I think we don't understand how the brain works at all. It's fascinating, but we really understand very, very little.
What is the relationship?
What really makes us tick.
What is the relationship of neurosurgery to neuroscience?
Very, very, very flimsy is the answer. I mean, we like saying it's like the relationship between plumbing and metallurgy and quantum mechanics, understanding how electrons behave in metals. There's a big gap. Neurosurgical decision-making is all about human values, human decisions. It's not about high-polluting understanding of the micro pathways in the brain.
Since you're dealing with delicate life and death issues and also the possibility that a person might survive brain surgery but never be him or herself again, does one need a large ego to even decide to become a brain surgeon?
Yes, I think you do. And that, of course, is a risk, because as patients, we are terrified of our doctors. We want to placate them, ingratiate ourselves with them. It's a bit different in America, where patients have a more consumerist approach. And, of course, they pay vast sums of money, and in England, you know, all medical treatment is free. Well, we pay for it through taxation.
Although you can go to a private doctor if you have the wherewithal.
You can, but most people don't. And if you have a serious problem, you're much better off in the government system than in the private sector. But Dr. Power Corrupts, as the great English historian Lord Acton said, all power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And yes, you go into surgery. I went into surgery because I was ambitious, competitive, had a big ego. There's no question of that. But you have to be very careful. You don't allow that to go to your head. I would like to think on the whole of neurosurgery that doesn't happen too much, because we all have terrible disasters and skeletons in our cupboard. But so I know, you know, there are many different types of surgeon. But there are, even in neurosurgery as well, I come across some terribly arrogant, complacent people who make me feel quite sick.
You say that.
I prefer my, sorry.
Now finish your thought. Sorry.
Well, I didn't say I prefer my surgeons rather anxious and, you know, self-critical rather than full of self-competence and egomania.
You say that when one applies to medical school, it's forbidden to say, I want to help people.
Well, in England, Now I'm told by American colleagues, it's the opposite, because they reckon everybody wants to become doctors because they want to make a lot of money. So you have to say, I really want to help people. But in England, it's said, you mustn't say that. But it's very curious, because actually, if you scratch most doctors and nail them down to the ground, most of us would say, well, actually, no, the reward of the work really is helping people and helping patients. So why mustn't you say that? And my explanation for that, and it's only a theory, is that we're all awkwardly balanced between the need for professional detachment and the need for empathy. And there's no easy way to find that balance. We've got to care for our patients and have compassion for them, but not too much. If you get too emotionally involved, you can't do the work. Not only do you have to see terrible things happening to patients, but you will make mistakes, things will go badly wrong, and you have to kind of learn to live with that. So my feeling is that why we feel threatened and embarrassed and awkward when we see pure, innocent young people who want to help people, because we were like that once and then realized it's much more difficult than that. We all have skeletons in our cupboard. We all have guilty secrets. And seeing these pure, idealistic young people who want to help people makes us feel uncomfortable, because it reminds us of that, how we were like that once, and we're not like that now. So that's my theory. Whether it's true or not, I don't know.
Does that make it a reason to lie to a patient? Is there a point when the patient is unable to face the truth, is in denial?
I guess that's incredibly difficult. It's a hugely important question. It's something I lecture about quite a lot. In England now, there is a legal obligation to tell patients the truth. Duty of candor, it's called. And the official guidance is, if a mistake has been made by anybody in the medical team, it is the duty of the senior doctor to tell the patient and the family, both verbally and in writing, that a mistake has been made. And in principle, I agree with that. But it's very difficult, because I can tell you a case I was involved in some years ago of a young woman who had been operated upon elsewhere. Basically, they'd done the wrong operation and left her very damaged. And then she was, because it was a cancerous tumor, although in principle one which was curable, she was referred for radiation, and the radiotherapy doctors said to me, look, there's still tumor left behind. You know, there's no point giving a radiation if we don't have all the tumor removed, all the visible tumor removed. So I operated, and there was the rest of the tumor. It was quite clear my colleagues at another hospital, God knows why, had operated in the wrong way. Now, and the poor woman was desperately disabled. Do you tell the family? In what way will it help them? Now, yes, all right, if it was America, they might get millions of dollars. Maybe in England they would as well. or that's less likely. And I agonized over that a lot, because it's bad enough to know that your daughter has been left terribly disabled because of a bad tumor, which might well prove fatal anyway. But if you're then told she's been left terribly disabled because of a medical mistake, it actually makes it even worse. You know, you then think this was avoidable. And it's, and I told the family, I was very reluctant to, but I said, well, I actually, you need to take legal advice, because I didn't really think the way the operation was done was right. And that was devastating for the family. I don't know what happened. I don't think they did actually go to court over it. I know in America, litigation is increasing a lot in England. It's not quite as bad as in America. But we need lawyers. We need to be held accountable. But sometimes by telling the truth, you make things even worse for the patient and family. And it's very difficult to get that balance right. And it's very tempting to brush it under the carpet, because these conversations are so painful. And it's often very easy to hide mistakes, you know, in a sort of medical way.
Well, how do you balance...
So very, very difficult.
How do you balance possibilities and risks? With brain surgery, isn't it possible to prolong a patient's life at the expense of the quality of that life?
This is a huge problem. I mean, one of the biggest problems in modern medicine, particularly, in my opinion, in America, which I know the system reasonably well, I was lecturing there a few weeks ago in Ann Arbor, is over-treatment. One of the commonest mistakes in medicine is to overestimate the risks of not operating, to operate on people who don't really need it, or people who are going to die anyway, despite surgery.
Do most patients expect surgery?
Most patients are desperate to go on living, is the answer. So they want something to be done. And one of the most difficult things in medicine is to look somebody in the eye and say, in effect, go away and die. And then you worry you might be wrong. Firstly, it's very painful to say that, you know, unless you're completely cold fish. It is horribly painful to tell a fellow human being that. Secondly, you always worry, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's a very small chance we can prolong this patient's life in a useful way. And as a result of this problem, you know, more and more countries, there's more and more really unnecessary operating being done. And again, it's partly related to the fact in all the developed, wealthy countries, the population of elderly people is getting greater. And clearly, to operate upon somebody at 80 for a tumor which will kill them within the next few years is very different from operating on somebody who's 20. So, and yet, then if you say, well, you're too old, you're accused of being ageist, you know? But these decisions are really difficult. And looking back at my career, I'm looking at colleagues' work, where problems arise in medicine, it's not the technical operating, it's all the decision-making. What is the balance of risk and benefit between operating and not operating? And then if it's reinforced by commercial considerations, as it often is in America and other countries, you know, people end up operating to make money rather than what's really in the patient's best interest.
Brain surgery is the topic on today's Leonard Lopate at Large. You have said that all doctors carry a cemetery with them that they visit from time to time. Who's in it?
Well, that's a quotation from a French surgeon called René Le Riche, who wrote that. I wish I'd written it myself. It's a great quote. We all carry an inner cemetery, and it's a place to which we have to go from time to time to think about our mistakes. And it's a place full of bitterness and regret. And I think it's very true for all senior surgeons. Of course, as the years go by, your inner cemetery gets, I'm afraid, it gets bigger and bigger. Again, there's a paradox. As you become more senior and more experienced, you'll take on more and more difficult cases. And your results get worse in some ways.
Which strikes me as a bit surprising. I would assume that as you have gained more experience, you would make fewer mistakes.
Well, you're not making mistakes, but you're taking on more fragile, vulnerable patients, where the balance between the balance of risk is more difficult to calculate.
Do you get perspective?
So, in a sense, if you say, if you tell a patient there's a 5% or there's a 1% risk, you'll die because of the operation, and the patient then dies, well, I'd say, well, I said there was a 1% risk. And they'll say, well, the family will say, well, you said the patient would be all right. I said, no. I said there was a 99% probability. So doctors deal in probabilities. They don't deal in certainties. And as you take on more difficult cases, what it means is the balance between the risk of surgery and the risk of doing nothing gets increasingly difficult.
Do you get perspective from learning from your mistakes?
Well, it's vital. And we all learn everything, whether it's brain surgery or anything else in life. We learn most from our mistakes. But the terrible problem is in medicine, and particularly in surgery, especially in brain surgery, is the consequences of our mistakes for our patients are so terrible that we tend to, the temptation is to hide them from ourselves, let alone from everybody else.
To actually face up to them is
very painful.
Mr. Williams is one of the patients that you wrote about. What kinds of behavior changes was he undergoing?
He had difficulties walking, and he developed what's called pathological laughter, laughing inappropriately, which is a kind of strange reflex, and difficulty swallowing. And it was a tumor where you would expect the patient to die, well, within the next 1 to 2 years, probably, from respiratory failure, from pneumonia, from not being able to swallow properly.
And his tumor was in his frontal lobe? His tumor was in his frontal lobe. What area?
No, this is in the brain, pressing on the brain stem. I don't know which patient. No, hang on, we talk about a different patient. That patient had a frontal tumor, yes, which presented with personality change, yes.
And yeah. I wonder what that area of the brain controls.
Social behavior, how you relate to other people. If people suffer damage to the front of the brain, it's a bit variable, but they may become very disinhibited, make inappropriate comments, they become insensitive to other people, things like that. And they become a sort of grotesque caricature of the person they were before the tumor started to have an effect.
I'm not going to go into all the details of that operation, that surgery,
but
when you started to operate on him, you say the brain tissue you were taking out seemed good. What do you mean by that?
Well, it looked like normal brain. As I said earlier, one of the problems is certain sorts of tumor, is the tumor looks like the brain. And in fact, it was a tumor, but I got very anxious during the operation. I wasn't in the right place. I mean, technically, I knew I was, but emotionally, I was very frightened I wasn't. And it wasn't an operation I was very keen to do. I was doing it, in fact, because a colleague was going to do it and couldn't do it. If I had seen the patient myself originally, I might not have opted for major surgery. I should have said just do a biopsy to confirm the diagnosis and then do nothing. But it's very difficult. You know, it's very difficult. If, you know, somebody's just there, there are no right or wrong answers. Some things in brain surgery are just impossible for decision making.
Was his recovery satisfactory? Would he ever be the same man he was before the tumor?
No, he probably is dead by now. All one could achieve with the surgery is possibly prolonging his life. But given he had suffered such major personality change, you could argue it wasn't really worth prolonging his life. From the family's point of view, but then from his point of view, even though he was no longer the man he was, he didn't know that. He thought he felt he was still himself. So you're faced by these totally impossible philosophical, ethical problems. And I don't know the answer to these at all. But it is, all I know is it's terribly interesting in a sort of way.
What made you decide to retire? Were the hospitals beginning to be run by consultants?
With increasing bureaucracy. In fact, I'm still working, but only part-time now, and I spend more time working in Ukraine and Nepal, and I'll be in Albania in 2 weeks' time. I got increasingly frustrated by the over-management. In that, I'm a great believer in socialized healthcare and single-payer systems. I think the American healthcare system, even at its best, it's fantastic, has enormous problems. I mean, in terms of the amount of money spent on it, is fantastically, epically bad value for money. But the National Health Service needs its problems as well at the other end of the spectrum, which is it's under-resourced. There's not enough money put into it by the government because the government doesn't want to put taxation up. So it's fantastic value for money. We achieve pretty good results by international standards, but at only a fraction of the cost of countries like America. But because the government's trying to squeeze blood out of a stone, there's more and more management, business consultants trying to run the health services or business. Medicine isn't really a business. And I just got fed up with increasing interference in my day-to-day working life by bureaucrats. So I had a sort of temper tantrum and retired.
To the point where surgeons and doctors were forbidden to wear coats and ties in the hospitals.
Yeah, no, exactly. It was just ridiculous, utterly stupid. I was trusted with patients' lives, but I was not allowed to dress as I saw fit, and that was not on.
Now, you mentioned the difference in the National Health Service, the way that is run and what happens in the United States. The United States is almost unique in terms of the way its medical system runs when you compare it with other Western countries.
Yes.
How much is the profit motive? How much of a role does the profit motive play? There's a section in your book where a division is being chastised for bringing in only $1 million when $3 million had been brought in the previous year.
Yeah. Well, I think the profit motive distorts decision making. I mean, on the one hand, yes, if doctors are going to make money out of treating a patient, they might treat the patient more quickly. But I think it also, even at an unconscious level, because surgical decision making is all about what are the risks of surgery, what are the risks of not operating, if the fact you're going to make money, if the hospital will make money, it tends to distort our understanding of the probabilities involved. And this has been shown by lots of psychologists. But our estimation of risk and probability is hugely influenced by lots of unconscious processes called cognitive biases. I don't think anybody could really disagree that commercial healthcare drives costs up. It doesn't make things not efficient. It's not cheaper. If you spend more money, yes, you get nicer hospitals, nice lighting, carpets, curtains, single rooms, all the nice things we don't have in government hospitals in England. But it does cost a huge amount of money. And in America now, it's like 20% of national income goes on healthcare. And yet the overall figures for life expectancy, infant mortality, disability-free life expectancy are the worst in the developed world. So something's wrong. Something doesn't add up.
So now you, in your semi-retirement, have gone to Nepal and Ukraine.
Yep.
Nepal is
I've been working in Ukraine for 26 years, off and on. Yeah.
You say you fell in love with Nepal, but...
Yeah, well, it is a bit, I mean, you know, it is a bit, Nepal's a bit like that. I mean, the Kathmandu is a hellhole. I mean, I didn't go there 40 years ago, and it was a very fashionable place to go. All the hippies trekked overland. It was a different world. You could cross Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and the only danger was getting hepatitis and diarrhea. It's rather different now. But there's something, well, partly it's the Himalayas, of course. And although Nepal is a very troubled country, a very difficult political situation, they had a pretty horrible civil war, which only ended almost 12 years ago. There's something very charming about the people. It's a sort of Buddhist Hindu culture. And I fell in love with the place, as many Westerners do, although I'm fairly realistic about the problems in the country, which is usual ones of corruption, over rapid urbanization, terrible pollution in Kathmandu, things like that.
Dev, a colleague there, told you he often has problems with families when a treatment goes badly. He says he's forced to operate and do treatments he considers useless.
Well, to some extent, yes. And I mean, I remember one family very unhappy about the result. They smashed all the hospital windows, and hospital and doctors get death threats and demands for money and blackmail, all sorts of things, because they don't have a well-developed system of litigation or complaints. And also, it's one of the poorest countries in the world. Most of the patients are more or less subsistence farm peasants and just don't understand if medical treatment goes badly. Their view is that means it's a bad doctor. They find it very hard to accept that maybe this is going to happen anyway.
Who's paying for it?
Well, they pay for it. I mean, in theory, state medicine is free, but everybody has to pay. Same in Ukraine. If you want the doctor to give you the proper drugs and things, you have to pay. Well, the Russian Ukraine phrases under the table. In all these poor countries where the state is relatively impoverished, the patients have to pay as though it's private practice, but it's all not transparent and not regulated.
But I found it amusing that you told Dev, only in America have I seen so much treatment devoted to so many chance of making a useful recovery.
Because money has clouded the whole
process?
Yeah. You know, people are unrealistic about outcomes. It's very curious.
In the UK, you spoke with the patient and the family before and after surgery. In Nepal, there is no personal or emotional contact. Does that make the procedure easier for you?
Yes, it probably does. And I was there in a sort of advisory ancillary role. So really most of the negotiation with the patients and the families was done by my Nepali colleagues. Yes, if you're more detached from patients emotionally, it's less stressful. You know, empathy hurts. And if you don't speak the language and it's a rather different culture, you feel a bit more detached. But having said that, though, I still would get very anxious and worried about some of the things I was doing in Kathmandu, as I did in London.
Go ahead.
Didn't make too much difference.
I was speaking with Dr. Henry Marsh, whose follow-up to his best-selling memoir, Do No Harm, is Admissions, just out from Picador. This is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. The stories in this book, the stories you tell are fascinating, sometimes horrifying. Do you think that what you have witnessed and knowing the limits of brain surgery has made you more aware of your own mortality?
Yeah, it's hard to judge because I've only had the one life. I think when we're medical students, we start learning about lots of horrible illnesses, which can start in very minor, subtle ways. And I don't know many doctors who, when they were medical students, didn't, for a short period of time, become very hypochondriacal and worried they were developing all the illnesses they were learning about. And then you have to decide, illness happens to patients, not to me. I am one of the elect. I am safe. And that sort of detachment, that alienation from patients, is an important way of protecting yourself and avoiding becoming too anxious. And it continues throughout your career. But as you get older, and I'm now 68, and you know your own wheels are starting to drop off, and I've been a patient myself, and my family have been patients, you know that sort of protective barrier weakens a bit. And then, of course, now I'm going to develop a serious illness, probably within the next few years, you know, and that frightens me a bit. But we do have to be kind of detached from patients, but not lose our humanity in the process. Now, the word empathy means actually technically to feel what somebody else is feeling. And obviously, you can't do that as a doctor. If you actually felt as anxious and frightened as your patient, you couldn't do the work. Anxiety is contagious. Doctors do not like anxious patients because it makes doctors anxious. A lot of what goes on in hospitals, which in many ways are rather like prisons, is all about reducing the burden of anxiety for doctors and nurses.
In his later years, your father suffered from dementia. Does that add to your sense of anxiety?
Oh, very much so. I mean, very, very much so. I'm a great believer in assisted dying, though it doesn't really apply to dementia, because if you're demented, you can't You can't voluntarily decide you want to bring your life to an end. But I'm horrified by the thoughts of many. It's a real problem. I mean, if you live to the age of 80, statistically, you have something like a 45% probability of getting dementia. If you live to the age of 90, it's much more than 50%. So dementia is a fate that awaits many of us. And it's a consequence of modern life. We all live too long, says he cheerfully.
You say that you weren't a good son. What do you mean by that?
I've had a very, very privileged upbringing in terms of my education, in terms of the way my parents supported me without dictating to me. I don't think I gave them very much in return. And they're both dead now, so you can't ask them. But I think I was always very... I'd like to think now that I'm older, I'm a little bit less egotistic and a little bit better at putting other people first. But I think I could have done more to help my parents in old age than I did.
And you write that your work abroad helped you realize the importance of your father's work. In what way?
Very much so. My parents were among the group of people who founded Amnesty International. My mother was a political refugee from Nazi Germany. She was German. She was in trouble with the Gestapo, the secret police. And in one sense, my father married her because they'd met in Germany, so she could come to England and escape the Gestapo. And my father was a lawyer, but he was one of the early human rights lawyers, a very, very fine man. And by working in countries like Ukraine and Nepal and Sudan, where justice is basically who's paid the judge the biggest bribe or has most political clout, the rule of law is something we tend to take for granted in the modern West. It is absolutely crucial and central to the idea of a free democratic society. Elections are meaningless if you don't have the rule of law. I mean, Putin is democratically elected in Russia, but there is no rule of law. The judicial system is totally subjugated to the political system. And this was what my father's work was all about over the years. And although I'm not emotionally suited to being a lawyer myself, I realize how incredibly important his work was. And how, it's all very well introducing democratic elections to Iraq and Afghanistan. But if a system is corrupt, if you haven't got the rule of law and independent judges, it doesn't really mean very much. And how do you introduce the rule of law and independent justice? Probably takes hundreds of years rather than just a few.
And there are serious immigration problems, not only in countries like Nepal, where pretty much all the Tibetans who worked with the Dalai Lama have moved to, but also the turmoil in Ukraine, perhaps less in Albania, but there are parts of Africa where there are also serious immigration problems. Why do you think we are so many countries are moving to the political right in response to the plight of immigrants?
That's a big question, isn't it? And yet it's something very real about it. I'm all for immigration in principle, because immigrants tend to be, look at America, immigrants tend to be young, dynamic, they work hard, they're not scroungers. So immigrants, in a slightly Darwinian way, are often a very, very powerful force for improvement and economic progress.
And as you point out, your mother was an immigrant.
And my mother was an immigrant, a political refugee. And I've always been a passionate European, which is why I find Brexit a terrible, terrible thought. Because I believe in Europe. There are many problems with the European community, but it's still the idea. We try to see all human beings as our equals is very important. That having been said, to have massive immigration at short notice, and it's going to get worse when global warming takes off, is very difficult. And I don't know what the answer to that is, really. What I do know is that the Britain depends on immigration to keep the economy going. And the areas in England which voted for Brexit were mainly areas with low immigration, older people who felt threatened by the thought, but not the actuality, of more immigrants coming in. America, I can't speak for. But all I was in, my understanding is that they're not so academic studies, showing that on balance, immigration is an engine for economic growth rather than the reverse.
In the few moments that we have left, how do you plan to spend your retirement, or semi-retirement? Will you be continue to write? Is there another book in the works?
Well, I'm still working. I still work part-time in the National Health Service in England. I've agreed to write a third book, although I say I don't want to be paid in advance. I find the idea of retirement terrifying. A New Yorker wanted to write an article about retirement, so I've got to sit down and think about that. So it's very difficult. But again, it sounds a very self-important thing to say, but having achieved a lot with my life, then what do I do next? I'm not willing to sit down and put a pair of slippers on and read the newspaper. So I do a lot of lecturing. I'm writing again. I've always been using my, I have a workshop. I make furniture. I'm rebuilding a cottage. Psychologically, I think I'm probably more of like a gyroscope. If I stop spinning, I fall over. So I have to keep busy all the time.
And Dr. Henry Marsh's latest book, Admissions, is published by Picador. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Dr. Henry Marsh, to Fran Higgins, who produced the segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, to Richie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, and to my assistant producer, Jesse Lent, who makes things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.